Welcome to the Art Museum of Chicago. I'm your host, Nathaniel MacLenn, and I'm honored to have with me a philosopher who is responsible partially for starting the entire movement in philosophy of environmental philosophy with his book, with his article rather, Animal Liberation. And now he's moved up to the human situation, asking us to be more compassionate in the way we treat others and handle other people. And serve the poor around the world. And I'm honored to have him with me, Mr.
Hi, Peter Singer. Nice to talk to your listeners.
The book?
I've just written a book called The Life You Can Save, Acting Now to End World Poverty. It's actually picking up a theme that is, for me, as old as my work on animal liberation. I wrote about this topic in 1972, when there was a refugee crisis in what's now Bangladesh. And that article has been reprinted in a lot of anthologies and produced a lot of comments and responses. So this book, in some ways, a response to those responses. But it also does, as you say, set out an argument and a proposal for how we ought to be thinking about our responsibilities. When I say our, I mean people in the affluent nations, basically, responsibilities towards those living in extreme poverty in the poorest countries of the world.
And you're asking, you're not just talking to nations and governments and foundations, you're asking people to make an individual commitment as well.
That's right. I mean, I think it's very easy for us to just slough off the responsibility onto governments and say, well, they should do it. But, in fact, the United States government in particular does not have a good record. It actually gives less foreign aid in proportion to the size of the United States gross national income.
As compared to the Scandinavian countries, for
example. Well, definitely. I mean, it gives maybe a quarter as much as the Scandinavian nations and less than the average of the rich nations.
Mm-hmm. I think as far as foreign aid is, like, actually 1% of our foreign of our national budget.
Yes, of federal government's budget. That's right. It's around that 1% figure, and Americans often think that it's much more. I quote in the book some figures where people say, "Well, we spend too much on foreign aid," but that's because they think it's about 20% of the federal budget. So then you ask them how much would be the right proportion, and they say, "Oh, 5 to 10%," and they're very surprised to learn that actually it's really only around 1%.
And there was a certain now former president who added all kinds of ideological conditions onto the aid.
Indeed, President Bush certainly did. That wasn't really at all helpful. And USAID has for a long time been targeted to U.S. political purposes as well. It's not really going just to help the poorest of the poor, because politically they're not, unfortunately, so significant. So that's one of the reasons why I think that we should take an individual responsibility as well. It's in our power. We don't have to just sort of lie back and say, well, you know, if the federal government won't change, I can't do anything. That's not true. There are hundreds or thousands of aid organizations, many of which are very good, effective organizations, which you can donate to. You can donate either money or time to them, in fact. That can make a huge difference to the lives of some people living in extreme poverty somewhere in the world.
And name some successes.
Some successes, right. Well, one of the organizations that I've supported for many years is Oxfam, which is an international coalition of organizations. So the national one here is Oxfam America. They supported a change of laws in Mozambique. They supported grassroots women's organizations in Mozambique that were protesting against property laws there, which had the effect that if a couple were married and living together, and they might have built a house and farmed the land for 20 years, and then the man died, the husband died, the property went to the man's family. None of it went to his wife, who had worked the land with him.
Or she would have to marry, in other circumstances in the African and the Middle Eastern world, she would be required to marry his brother or cousin.
That could also be a possibility in some places, that's right. So Oxfam worked with women's organizations in Mozambique to change the law, and they succeeded in getting the law changed, and that law no longer applies in Mozambique. So that's a very distinct success, I think, which will help many women who would have been extremely impoverished otherwise. There are also a lot of health successes. There's an organization called the Fred Hollows Foundation that encourages doctors to spend some of their vacation in poor countries doing eye operations. And it's amazing how they can restore sight in people who are blind for a cost of around $50 per person. You know, that's a sort of, in the United States, you can't do anything. You can't poke your nose into a doctor's office for $50, really. Mm-hmm. But that's all it costs to restore someone's sight.
Well, let me play the devil's advocate. Isn't what these people need are free markets? I mean, open up their markets to global corporation and get grants from the World Bank and open themselves up to free markets, privatize their water. Look how successful privatization of water has been in South Africa and Argentina.
Well, I see you're putting a University of Chicago economics department view here. Right.
Chicago school.
Yeah, right, yeah. Look, I mean, you know, I certainly don't think that privatization of water is, as those examples, a great success. But as for opening up trade, I do agree, and I think I would agree with the Chicago School, that American and European agricultural subsidies are a disaster for the poor countries. Because, you know, you have, in West Africa, say, you have millions of small peasant cotton growers, and they produce cotton quite efficiently, quite cheaply, more cheaply than U.S. cotton growers and with far less fossil fuel input. But because the U.S. subsidizes its cotton growers to the tune of about $3 billion a year, the U.S. cotton growers can put their cotton on the market at prices below African cotton growers, and so the Africans don't get a decent return for their work. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that there I agree. You know, that subsidy should go, and if people want to work for the removal of those agricultural subsidies, that is really, I would see that as a kind of aid. That's an effective thing to do. But, you know, there are other things you can do too, including improving public health in the developing world, improving education, helping with farming techniques, providing better seeds, you know, some new techniques. There's a lot that can be done, and there's a lot that has been shown to work.
Well, what are the basis of your philosophical arguments? Are you a social reform environmentalist, or do you think that anthropomorphism or the centrality of the Western worldview of the man, Western is the dominion of nature, we're the agents of civilization, we're the servants of agents of God, agents of knowledge, agents of truth, and everything centers around us, and we have the white man's burden, and we have the are you influenced by Jeremy Bentham or Kant? How do you feel in this anthropomorphism argument, which is very, very much a debate in the world of environmental philosophy?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Well, obviously, my views on animals in my book Animal Liberation and elsewhere suggest that I don't think that humans are the only thing that matters. I think that other species matter as well. We've got to take the interests of non-human animals into account. That's true. I am influenced by Jeremy Bentham and the British Utilitarian School of Philosophy, which means that we judge things by their consequences, by whether they make beings better off. And I think that, you know, if you wanted to say what's the common thread between the different things that I've written about animals, about euthanasia, for example, and about this issue of helping the world's poor, it's the idea that there is a lot of unnecessary suffering in the world. There's a lot of suffering in the world that we could, at relatively small cost to ourselves, reduce, maybe completely stop, but anyway, definitely dramatically reduce. And so that's what I'm talking about here, and I'm just influenced by this idea that reducing unnecessary suffering is the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Now tell me, is your bias toward You said animal liberation. Is your bias toward rights of beings, or do you believe like an environmental view in terms of environmental systems? Because I know that's kind of a debate. Some eco philosophers argue that we should be more concerned about the domesticated animals and cattle are having devastating impacts on the wild animals, and these populations should be reduced. But a lot of people in the liberation movements are very concerned with domesticated animals, and then the issue of experimental of animals right here in I won't say right here, but at some universities and some cosmetic institutions and labs or whatever, that's kind of ignored. So you have this debate between the people taking a broad environmental view and people look at particular animals and creatures, and then tell me how that ties in with people.
Well, I suppose my focus is more on individuals, sentient beings who can feel pain or suffer and who can have good lives, not so much on broad ecological systems. I find it difficult to know really exactly how you would extend ethics to an ecological system as a whole if that's not a sentient being. Although, of course, it's important to protect ecological systems, mm-hmm. precisely because...
I think the argument goes that bees come and go, but the hive represents the continuum.
Well, it does, and so the hive is important because there are going to be bees, and you could say, you know, the forests are important because there are going to be animals living in them, and there are humans, for that matter, who need forests as well. So, you know, that's true. Going back to what you were saying before about domesticated versus wild animals, I think environmentalists and animal liberationists are completely in agreement that we should be cutting the number of domestic animals that we have, because they're a huge contributor to environmental damage, especially to global warming. And also, you know, the animal liberationists would say, and the ways in which we keep them cause an immense amount of suffering. So there's a real convergence of positions there, and both environmental and, you might say, animal rights positions coincide in saying that we should be cutting drastically the number of animals that we have, particularly in factory farms and feedlots, these very intensive methods of keeping them, which are terrible for them and terrible for the environment.
Why are your ideas important now? Why do you think they resonate now?
Well, I've written this most recent book, The Life You Should Save, The Life You Can Save, now, because I think we are at a point where we could get really serious about the problem of global poverty. We could really make dramatic inroads in it. I think, not everywhere, maybe. There are some countries where the governments are so repressive we can't really intervene in a useful way, but in many places we can. We're building up more expertise on what actually works in these countries. And we have the resources, just because we've made some progress with world poverty over the last 40 years. It's a smaller proportion of the world's population now than it ever was. And we have great wealth, despite the present economic downturn. We still have great wealth in the world that really could be used to make an impact on world poverty.
Also, if you lifted up the poor, there would be larger markets, and maybe that could contribute to the ending of this economic crisis that we're in. If the quality of life was raised in say in Africa, as the Chinese are pouring tons of money into, maybe that could and in South America, with the way they're trying to consolidate, some of these countries are trying to consolidate and create their own individual banking system, free the World Bank. Maybe it's the time for your ideas.
Well, yes, definitely. If we can expand the world's economy and bring the poor into it, that will be good for us all. It will be good for the poor, would be good for us. And maybe will lead to a more peaceful and harmonious world as well, because there's no doubt the inequalities have something to do with some of the...
So thank you, Professor Singer, for being on the Art Museum of Chicago. And tell our listeners the name of the book again.
The book is called The Life You Can Save, and if I could also mention that there's a website that I've set up to push the general idea of the book. So the website is thelifeyoucansave.com, and people can go there and take a look, and they can make a pledge to do something about this issue. There's lots of information about good organizations to donate to, so take a look at that and take a look at the book. Thanks very much for talking to you.
Thank you very much. And this is WHBK, the Pride of the South Side, 88.5 FM.